We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
From Illinois Public Media, this is Focus on WILL Radio and online at will.illinois.edu. Good morning. I'm Celeste Quinn. The producer for the program, Harriet Williamson. Our technical director this morning, Jason Croft. On the program in this hour, computers and you. This is a topic we take up here in the 11 o'clock hour of Focus on the first Thursday of the month. And this month, Peter Kimball is our guest. He's with the Fast 3 Consortium, Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Listeners, I welcome your questions about computers for Peter. Join us with a telephone call or by email. The email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. And here are the phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. And our toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Peter, good to see you.
Oh, it's good to be back. Thank
you. Welcome back. Well, we have a caller waiting to talk with you. This is a listener in Champaign County on line one, so go right to the phone. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Kimball. My question is regarding the Sites Express mail deactivation for UVI retirees. Are you familiar with that?
Yes, I am.
Great. So do you have any words of wisdom to make a smooth and trouble-free transition to this process?
Well, let me, yes, I've actually gone through that with several other people. For those others who may not be familiar with this but are associated with the U of I, there has been an old mail system, which the university calls Express Mail, that many faculty, staff, and, of course, retirees had been using. And it's running on old systems and old software, and as part of the university's move towards what they're calling unified communications, they're moving everybody to more state-of-the-art equipment, including moving everybody's mail account off of the old machine onto what's called a Microsoft Exchange server. So what does that mean? That means that anybody who has been using the older email program, which is practically all retirees, I would suspect, have to change, and the date of final conversion is only about 3 months off. So current, there's a whole series of websites on the site's location that will give you some guidance for this. Basically, what you'll want to do is to go into your normal email program and clean up any of the old mailboxes, any of the old mail that you really don't want to have converted if you've got lots of stuff sitting around. And then you're going to want let me ask one question. What program are you using to actually check your email? Are you using a web browser? Are you using
Outlook Express?
Okay. If you're using Outlook Express, then you'll be able to tell Outlook Express that you want to redirect it to, once the conversion has been made, to look at the site's Exchange server. And there are specific pages that you will find on the site's website that will give you step-by-step instructions for doing that, not only for Outlook Express, but also for the full-fledged version of Outlook.
All right.
It will behave very much the same. You will actually have to spend about 1 day without email when you go to the website or every other retiree who is using the old Express system. When you go there, you can specify a date that you would like the conversion to be made, August 15th, September 1st, as long as it's before the end of October. And then when that day comes, they ask that you not log into your email, and you will, and you'll be able to then go to, after that day is over, go to an address which they will have sent you, and you'll simply find all of your email transferred. All of your email will start going to the new Exchange server, and all of your old email will be transferred and be in a folder. And it's a relatively painless process, and there's a lot of guidance, and it's actually a pretty simple process to make that conversion.
Good, good. I'll let you know that. Well, you know, maybe this is just the resistance to change factor or whatever. But, you know, I saw this, oh, gosh, another change. Now what am I going to do?
Well, you're in better shape than many who are using other email clients such as Eudora and such, who have to make not only a change to their location of their email, but also really can't use their old email program. You'll continue to be able to use Outlook Express.
Great, great. So, and I did go to the website, and it is a thing that says Seek Change 2010 Email and Software Instructions. So that's probably what you're talking about on the Outlook Express instructions.
Yes.
So I can do that at home. I don't have to go in the site's office for that?
You don't have to go into the site's office, but the site's help office, the site's help desk, does have a team of people specifically dedicated to assisting people with that transition. So if you get stuck, you can indeed go in there. I'd probably call and make arrangements to do so. And they can actually walk you through the process or help you get your email client set up if you have difficulty attaching it to your new email location.
Now, I have a desktop machine. Does that apply to a desktop, or is that just a laptop?
Well, you're going to have two ways of getting to your email. You can certainly use Outlook on the on your desktop, although you clearly could not easily bring your desktop into Sites. But the other thing they'll be able to show you, there is a very nice web-based email client that works with the new email services, which has much greater functionality than any sort of website that you may have used to check email from other locations. It's really quite effective, and they could certainly run you through that and show you. And that gives you the advantage of being able to check your email wherever you may be without having to have a machine with Outlook or without having to have a machine configured at all.
Okay, great, great. So are any people, does anybody have any difficulties or in updating their Outlook Express after their migration's finished?
The only difficulties that I'm aware of have been, first of all, those who have to move from some other email program, such as Eudora, to Outlook. There's a learning curve there, and until they get used to it, it can be fairly confusing.
Okay.
On occasion, people may have some difficulty of getting connected to the Exchange server, but that's mostly because the instructions weren't clear to them, and those sorts of things can be straightened out very easily. In terms of generic functional difficulties, no. It seems to be a very smooth process.
Great, great. I'm glad. Good. You point one of these. Thanks a lot, Mr. Kimball.
You're quite welcome.
Thanks for the call this morning. Other calls, questions are invited about computers this morning. Join us with a phone call or by email, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. And the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. You mentioned Eudora as a mail system, and that it might be more complicated for folks to move things if they were changing with that system. And also, a little bit before the program today, you mentioned that a new operating system, Apple's Lion, is making things tough for people who are using Eudora.
Well, it is. The Eudora program was very popular for a time, and it was actually developed as a result of a former U of I student, U of I alum. And it was a very nice email client. Now, an email client is simply a program that you run on your local computer, and its job is to connect to wherever your mail is coming, fetch the mail, and display it to you and let you respond. The problem with Eudora, with this new exchange system the university is putting in, is that Eudora doesn't talk effectively, is very inefficient and slow, and perhaps not entirely reliable in communicating with a newer technology email service, such as what's called Microsoft Exchange. So those who are currently using Eudora will simply have, in addition to the fairly simple process of changing over to the new email service, the fairly difficult or confusing process of switching to a new email program when they've been spending years and years using Eudora. There's also an issue of email that they have read and stored using Eudora locally, So it's no longer on the mail server because it may be several years ago, but they're keeping it as an archival resource. They won't be able to open that directly with programs other than Eudora. Eudora kind of does things in its own way. So that is an issue as well, and there's a potential solution for that. So basically, the transition from one email service to the other with U of I goes very smoothly itself, but it's complicated if somebody has to change their programs to read the email from Eudora to something else. On the other side, on the Macintosh side, Apple has recently released the new version of the Mac OS called OS 10 Lion, the update from Snow Leopard. And one of the main features of Lion is it has an interface very much like the interface for iPads and iPhones. So there's some fairly major changes, and those who use iPads a lot just love this because now their desktop behaves in much the same way. The difficulty is that there has been a program on all of the versions of Mac OS prior to Lion called Rosetta, as in the Rosetta Stone, which allows older programs not really designed for OS X to function properly. And a lot of Mac users have preferred using the Eudora program, the email client, the fetch and read and write your email program on Macs because it was much better than a lot of the Apple offerings and other things. However, Rosetta is no longer available for Mac OS X Lion, which means those who are using Eudora will no longer be able to use it if they upgrade to the Lion operating system. So that means that those who are using OS X Snow Leopard or something prior to that, if the time comes when they need to update to a newer version, Lion or whatever its successors are, they're going to also have to stop using Eudora. So that's going to prevent a number of people from updating as soon as they might otherwise do so. The question is, when are some other applications or some other software coming out that will require the newer operating system, at which point they'll be between a rock and a hard place? Do I update so I can see these and use these new applications and therefore have to change my email program, or do I stay with the old one? I can keep using all my email and all the archived stuff is available to me, but I can't do the new things.
Yeah. What is the word overall about Lion?
It seems to be very positive. There is a major emphasis on the part of Apple to try to bring together all of the various operating systems, and that's why Lion now behaves much more like iPads and iPhones, complete with the 2- and 3- and 4-finger swipes and moves on the trackpad or on the input device that you're using. So those who are primarily spending a lot of time on the iPad love it. Those who are standard keyboard-based Macs and using the older Mac operating system have a little bit of getting used to. They're going to spend a bit of time figuring out what's going on, especially if they're not also already iPad users. Apple made the decision to try to bring it all together, and there's going to be a bit of discomfort for those who haven't been using the iPads but have been using the old Macs if they update right away.
Yeah. I recently got an iPad, and I think it's a pretty sweet device, and I found it to be pretty intuitive.
It is. The only difficulty is going to be for people who are not used to using it and are used to the Mac with the keyboard and the mouse and such. It'll take some getting used to, but that also probably keeps people's brains a little bit more flexible, and, you know, if you have to adjust to the change, change is good sometimes.
Yeah. The tablet did not come with much in the way of instructions. And so I'm wondering what kind of resources are there. Is there a particular, there's, you know, the Books for Dummies series, and is there one that you particularly are fond of? The Missing Manual?
Well, the Missing Manual series is very good for those things it covers, but to my knowledge, it does not cover Mac OS X, certainly Lion. My generic advice for anybody who's looking for a printed resource would be to go to one of the big online sites such as Amazon, do a search for the book of that particular topic, and then look at the reviews. And if a book has more than a few reviews, of maybe a few hundred, and they're fairly positive, then there's a good chance that that will be a reasonable resource. Of course, if a book only has 2 or 3 reviews and they're very positive, that could be from the author's mother, uncle, and agent.
That's right. This is Focus, and this morning in this portion of the program, we're talking about computers with Peter Kimball. He is with the Fast 3 Consortium Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this morning with a telephone call or by email. The telephone number is in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. The toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL, and the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, it has been extremely warm and extremely uncomfortable here in the beginning of August and in the last portion of July, and it got me to thinking, you don't want to leave your groceries in the car for any period of time. I think it's got to be bad for electronic devices as well.
Yes and no. Certainly you don't want to leave your device in a car where the sun can shine on it, because that can add 10, 15, 20 degrees. If it's simply in a car in the shade and not operating, which of course it probably isn't in mm-hmm. the car, most devices are, their specifications are, their inactive temperatures can easily go up to 120 or 125 with no real problem. The difficulty would be if you were in that environment and actually running it, the internal heat not being able to dissipate as quickly because of, you know, the extreme high temperatures. So you wouldn't want to leave your laptop running and doing things while you shut your car up and go off and, you know, do whatever you're doing for an hour or so. But just as a stored device, inactive, not sitting in the sun, mm-hmm. You definitely want to keep it in the shade. Even the trunk would be better than sitting on a seat where the sun could hit it, aside from security issues. Nobody will see it
right,
in the trunk.
Right.
It shouldn't be a problem.
Okay. Let's take a call. This is a listener in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Yes. I'm not sure who to ask this question to, so I guess that's what I'm asking you, where I should go. Yesterday I was trying to get on my online banking, and it would take my user ID and my password, and then as soon as I would try to log in, it would just come up with the regular page. I called the bank, and he kind of walked me through some things, and then he asked me about what browser I use. And so then I tried it on my HP. The Apple is the one that I couldn't get on. And I could get into the system. So it's not a banking problem. I guess it's, but I hadn't done anything to my Apple. And I'm just wondering, why would something like that happen? And how would I figure out how to get it so that I could use it for my online banking?
Had you been accessing your online banking from your Apple computer in the
sure.
past?
Oh, yes. Yeah. That was my main source. Yeah.
Okay.
And it doesn't come up saying your password's wrong or anything like that. It just comes right up clear again, just to, like I was going to start all over.
And are you using, what browser are you using on the Apple, Safari or Firefox?
Safari. Mm-hmm. And I looked at the property he walked through, because he thought maybe I had some kind of, we went through that, and it still didn't change anything. And I hadn't messed with anything, so that was what was so.
And there had been no, Apple periodically has software updates, and none of those had happened just prior or.
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I have been using, I was away for a week, so, I mean, unless it did something on its own. You know, I mean, you know, like automatically. But usually it asks me if I want to update something.
Well, I'm not a regular user of Safari, so
uh-huh.
I assume that the person at the bank ran through a number of things, such as clearing the cache or the local storage of old pages, which you can do. I'm not quite sure the menu choices. That's the first thing I would recommend. Somewhere under the tools or elsewhere, you'll be able to say clear away all information about prior pages. So that can sometimes be an issue. The other thing you can do, of course, if you were using logging in from your desktop machine, were you using Safari there as well?
The HP, I was using Explorer.
Okay. Well, the other thing you could do on your Mac is, just to sort of experiment a little bit, would be to download Firefox for the Macintosh, and then I'm relatively sure that using the Firefox browser you would be able to access the banking site. It sounds very much like there is a setting or some issue or some slight corruption in some of the stored page information on your with your Safari browser.
Okay.
The other question would be, have you, although this is not commonly a problem with the Mac, there could be other software that is interfering with it. Have you got any sort of antivirus or firewall software installed on your Macintosh?
Not since, nothing new.
Nothing new.
No.
Well, my suggestion would be, twofold. One would be see if you can clear the cache. Now, this may be something that the banking representative suggested that you do. That's
and
the.
How do I go? Do I go to properties and do that?
It would be, and I don't have Safari available to me on a machine here. What you could do is to get the instructions on how to do that, just do a Google search,
okay.
Clear cache, that's C-A-C-H-E, Safari, and it'll
okay.
certainly tell you how to do that.
Okay, well, I'll try it. And otherwise, do you think the Apple people would be the people I should ask, talk to?
You could certainly try, but that's generally not very successful.
Okay.
They will say, well, it's not really our problem. Can you browse to our website? Yes, everything is fine.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, of course, as long as you're doing a search for how to clear the cache, would be to actually put some search terms. Safari doesn't load page after password or something of that sort and
okay.
see if others have that. And then, of course, you have the option to simply download the Firefox browser to the Macintosh,
okay.
which a lot of people use instead
sure.
of Safari.
Yeah, and I did use that before I got an Apple. So
and it's much the same on the Mac as it is on.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's very helpful. Thank you.
Well, good luck to you.
Bye-bye.
And next we talk with a listener in Urbana on line two. Hi.
Hello. A question about the switch over to the new site's mail. I use Thunderbird. Is that right?
Yes,
yeah,
the email, the Mozilla email client, yeah.
And am I going to have the same problems that I would have with Eudora?
Well, Thunderbird, again, it's not a program that I use. I'm aware of it. It is an email handling program kind of from Mozilla Foundation. Thunderbird, the question is how well will Thunderbird be able to talk to the new Mac, or to the new Exchange server? And let me just take a look. It's quite possibly going to be Thunderbird and Exchange 2010, and I'm just kind of taking a quick look at that. They've had a few complaints about not being able to connect to clients using the Exchange 2010 server. It should work. And then there's another location at the Mozilla home about not being able to download clients. You might want to, if you're moving to Exchange, I know you've been using Thunderbird, you might want to take a look at just the Exchange web app, which you can run. I would probably direct that specific call about how it will work to the site's help desk. Their
mm-hmm.
number is 244-7000. And there are apparently some issues, and I don't see any direct resolution, but there are a number of websites that I've found using Google about setting Thunderbird to work with Microsoft Exchange Server. So my suggestion would be to go ahead once you've made the transition, see how well it works with Thunderbird, and if you have difficulties, deal with them as they come. They don't seem to be consistent.
Okay.
So there's a good chance that things will work just fine. Thunderbird does know how to talk to the new email system.
It does?
Yes.
Okay.
There are some people who are having a few issues, and it's not clear from what I'm reading that those are inherent in the Thunderbird exchange connection, or if it's just something peculiar with individuals' own configurations.
The exchange mail, it used to be a little more vulnerable to viruses than some of the other Thunderbird in particular, where you could set everything to text. Can you set everything to text rather than having a graphical interface?
Yes, that's all controlled not so much by the fact that your email is sitting out there on Exchange, but it's controlled by the program that you're using to fetch and display your email, which could be Thunderbird or it could be the Outlook Express if you're running on a Windows machine, or the full-fledged Outlook, or almost any other program, the direct browser online web access program, which is supported. Those are the programs that can be told that you only want to see the text and to not do any of the HTML. And by default, for example, Outlook only shows you, doesn't download any images, doesn't download any scripts unless you click and say, yes, I trust this program or I trust this email.
I see.
So you will have the same options to control that.
And the web interface is the Express interface that you were...
No, the Express, the Express web interface, when you use your web browser to go to your currently existing Express email account, that is a much more primitive website than the new site that you will go to with your browser to check your Exchange mail. The web pages that you use to go to check Exchange are much better done, much more modern, and much more powerful. You'll still use your browser, whether it's Internet Explorer, Firefox, or Safari, but the address to which you'll go and the web pages that you see that show your email will be quite different and quite a bit more functional when it's talking to the Exchange location as opposed to the old Express.
With my laptop, I always use the web interface, the site's web interface.
Yes.
Because I didn't want to download.
Sure.
And I suppose I'll continue to do that, but it sounds as though it's going to be a more pleasant experience.
It will be a much more pleasant experience, yes. And it's all you'll do is you'll simply have a different address. It'll be webmail.illinois.edu instead of your express.sites.whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, it doesn't sound too painful. I guess I'll have to get at it one of these
Yes,
days.
It's going to be a change for a lot of people, but within a week or so of using it, I think you'll be glad that the change was made.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you.
You're quite welcome.
This is Focus, and this morning we're talking about computers with Peter Kimball. He's with the Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. I'm Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this morning with a phone call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we got a little note from a listener by email. And she says what you need to do, as far as she understands it, is that before you move to Outlook, you want to export your contact list.
Yes. The automatic conversion that sites will do is going to basically transfer all the email and not the contact list. So if they are maintaining their contact list at the U of I's Express email service as opposed to locally on their machine, they'll definitely need to export that because that does not make the transition. And that also, if those who are making this change read through some of the site's documentation, is mentioned there. One reason that there's so much concern about this now is that just a few days ago, the university, after having already started the conversion process for current faculty, staff, and students, sent out email to all retirees currently using Express saying, as you may know, we're making this change and you need to do so within the next 3 months one way or another, because on October 31st we're having to pull the plug on the old service. So everybody who may not have been aware of it before now are, because they've gotten emails saying the time has come. So they have a couple 3,000 retirees that they'll be moving. And we've had a couple call us.
We have. This is Focus, and this morning we're talking about computers. We can discuss new trends in technology, safe computing, and, of course, listeners, your questions and comments are invited. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. More after a short break.
On the next Fresh Air, Andy Serkis describes playing an ape in Rise of the Planet of the Apes. He did it with the help of computer-generated imagery, like he did in the Lord of the Rings films playing Gollum, whose tortured voice was inspired by Serkis's cat coughing up fur balls.
You see this fur about to be chucked up, and then they sort of go...
Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
And coming up tomorrow on Focus in the 10 o'clock hour of the program, David Inge will talk with music critic Simon Reynolds about what Reynolds calls retromania, pop culture's addiction to its own past. And then in the 11 o'clock hour tomorrow, I'll be in the host's seat and we'll talk about dogs, our monthly care on dog care and behavior with dog trainers Carol Lindholm and Jim Keel. That's tomorrow on Focus. This morning, we're talking about computers with Peter Kimball. Listeners, you're invited to join us. Questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. The email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. And we've got a call coming in on line 4. This is a listener in Chicago. Good morning.
Good morning. I would like to know about Internet Explorer 8 versus Internet Explorer 9. When I have used 9, the pages will lock or the screen will lock, and I've had to restart, reboot. Then I tried a more recent update, which Microsoft insists I should really have, and it will lock, but then it will say, oh, let us try to figure out how to take care of that. Ah, that's done, but then it will lock again. And I'm wondering, is there going to be one that won't lock up my screen all the time?
Well, that's an excellent question, and several other people have had difficulties of that same sort. The underlying problem, in many cases, seems to be web pages that are written using various shortcuts that they really shouldn't have used in the first place, but they've worked fine on previous versions of Internet Explorer. And now with the under, and it's almost always going to be a page that is dealing with underlying JavaScript. And that has been tightened up and is going to be, Internet Explorer 9 is less forgiving of things that shouldn't be done. And that is often why it, at least temporarily, will lock up. Solutions. One thing that's happening is, although we have no control over this, is that websites as they, and web managers and developers, as they realize that their sites are having trouble with this, are fixing them so that they work better without all the little quirky shortcuts that they've taken. There is also, this may or may not help, in Internet Explorer 9, there is a button over there to the right of the address bar to operate in compatibility view, and you can set that as a default case so that it behaves much more like Internet Explorer 8. The short answer to the question is that, yes, I'm sure that Microsoft is aware of this, and Internet Explorer 10, which should be coming out by the end of the year, if not the very first part of 2012, will certainly try to address that, I suspect, although there's no official word.
Thank you very much.
Uh-huh.
You're very welcome. Next, we take a call from a listener in Champaign. Line 1, hi.
Yes, good morning. I have a question regarding my Outlook Express. I run it on PC, on XP. I've been using it for, God, more than 10 years. As of last Wednesday, it stopped sending. It will receive, stop sending, and I check all the settings according to all the information I gave, my POP server, SMTP ports. Everything is correct the way it's supposed to be, but it does not send. I was going to ask, are you aware of any recent changes or a security patch or something that they have installed that makes it not to send? I can send webmail, no problem. I send and receive. But the Outlook Express does not send.
And what is the are you connecting to university mail?
No, not at all. I use my internet provider, AT&T. We got the
okay. I'm unaware of any changes AT&T has made, but if your Outlook is not sending the normal, do you get any error messages? Or does
yes, I do.
And what is the what kind of error message does it tell you?
Two of them, 0x800 CCC90 and 0x800 CCC18.
What I would suggest, that those can be, those sound like they could be messages resulting from a failure to authenticate with AT&T's mail service. They may have added or changed the way in which, or tightened up the way in which your mail sending portion of your program has to communicate and authenticate. The best place, and I don't know if you've done this yet or not, would be to contact technical support with AT&T.
Mm-hmm.
And tell them that you are having difficulty sending mail, that it's the same Outlook program. I'm just taking a look to see if I can see.
I do not use Outlook. I use Outlook Express.
Outlook Express. Well, yes, that's what I meant to say. CCC79. And there are, I just take a... oh, that's interesting. There are. I just took a look at a number of references to that by just typing those error message codes into Google,
okay.
And it is definitely a issue with how the mail server is handling the mail. Depending on, and I presume that you get this error message no matter whom you're trying to send the email
that's
to.
Right. Yeah.
So when you try to send an email message to yourself, which
absolutely.
Is the ultimate
same
test.
Thing. Yes.
So, yes, your solution then would be, or your best path to a solution would be to talk to contact AT&T technical support on the website for email. Say you've changed nothing, and I imagine that there is one of the authentication settings that either got changed on your end inadvertently or that perhaps AT&T had tightened up on, but those are the kinds of error messages that you will get when the mail server says, I don't like this and I'm not going to deal with it.
Okay. I have talked to AT&T and we compared where my setting has to be and all that. Everything is okay. They said they no longer support Outlook Express as far as the technical part of it goes. And they refer me to another site, through their own site. But there is a $15 fee monthly and a minimum of year sign up.
Yeah, that's pretty expensive.
Yeah.
As far as Outlook Express, if they're no longer supporting it, which is surprising because Outlook Express is pretty widely used, do you happen to have on your machine? Now, I don't recall. Did I ask you? Are you using? I presume you're using a Windows machine then, since you're on
yes.
XP.
Yes.
Do you happen to have the Microsoft Office suite installed, Microsoft Word and such?
Yes, I do.
So what you might consider then, because along with Microsoft Word and PowerPoint and all the rest of Microsoft Office comes the full-fledged version of Microsoft Outlook.
Okay.
And so it's very similar, but of course more powerful than Outlook Express and can certainly connect to the same kind of mail services mm-hmm. that... that Outlook Express connects to. So
I have not set up my Outlook, but I can set it up and see what happens.
Well,
here.
And the advantage of that is that if AT&T says they no longer support Outlook Express, they certainly will be supporting the full-fledged Outlook.
Okay. May I make a correction that they didn't say they don't support it. They say as far as the technical stuff, they cannot do anything more that they have done with me, and I got to go to this paid technical service or whatever to do that.
Well, before you would do that, what I would do is just go to Google, type in those 0x800cc things, and you'll get a whole page of people who have had similar errors and how to fix them.
Okay.
And I'd take a look at that
very
first.
Well. Thank you very much for your help.
You're quite welcome.
Thank you.
Let's take another call. This is a listener in Urbana on line 2. Hi.
Hello. A couple things. One, the woman who was having trouble signing in from her Mac with Busey besides dumping the cash, she might want to go and use disk utility in the application folder and repair her permissions. I found sometimes that if my Mac starts doing things or not doing things, if I can repair the permissions using disk utility on the hard drive, that quite often I can get the thing to work again.
Excellent suggestion. Thank you.
Yeah. Sometimes finding disk utility is a little difficult. It's in the utility folder in the application folder, so it's not readily apparent. But the other thing I wanted to ask about is I just got a new Mac running 10.6, and I also hate the names Leopard, Snow Leopard, Tiger, Lion, all that, because I can never figure out what the what system they're associated with.
Yeah, I know.
But I got a new new PowerPoint for Mac 2011, and I have found that it's done something with the colors. Basically, I have old PowerPoint presentations that I had a color where I had to make backgrounds on images that I put in Photoshop, and I put them in the old PowerPoint, and the colors match. Now, I open those old files in the new PowerPoint, and the colors don't match. Now, I've done some searching on the web, and most of the people seem to blame it on Photoshop. But I've taken Photoshop images off the new Photoshop and put them in the old PowerPoint, and the colors match. So you might not be able to help me, but can you kind of point me maybe into some place where I might be able to find that out? I've done some searching, and I haven't been able to find too much.
Well, I think you have come up with a truly bizarre problem. So basically what you're saying is that the same image from Photoshop, when placed into the older PowerPoint, I don't know, 2008 or something.
Or even older than that and newer than and about up to that age.
Okay. Appear when you're displaying either the actual, I assume the colors are off when you're doing it in 2011, whether you're just looking at the screen in PowerPoint editing mode or actually performing.
Anyway, I'll fix it. And sometimes I'll even take those and put them in the older one and they'll match. And then I'll send them off to somebody else who's got the newer version and they say, well, the colors don't match.
Hmm. Well, my only...
And I can't find, in PowerPoint, I can't find any way of adjusting the color settings.
Is there in Photoshop... this is one place I would go back and look. In Photoshop, when you are storing the images, are you storing them with a color profile?
Usually when I open up images in Photoshop, I don't manage the color settings.
Well, when you save a file, and I presume you're saving these since they're going into Photoshop as or into PowerPoint as JPEGs or something.
Yeah, JPEGs for PowerPoint.
You might want to, generally when you save it as a JPEG, you actually have there's a checkbox there in Photoshop about color profile. Clear that. It could well be that PowerPoint 2011 is reading that color profile and making adjustments that older versions of PowerPoint didn't. I'm just guessing at this because I've not heard of this problem before and haven't looked into it.
Okay.
But that
I'll put that on my list of things to look at. And they also got rid of, as far as I can tell, unless they've hidden it, they've rearranged things. And some of the things I like the rearrangement of, and some it makes doing things that I was able to do very easily before very difficult to find. I really don't like PowerPoint, but everybody uses it, so I have to use it.
Right.
Which is, I really don't like the whole Office group, but that's... That's another thing altogether.
Oh, welcome to the real world.
No lie. Okay, well, I'll add that to the list of things. But they used to have an eyedropper where you could sample a color, and it would put it in the mixture, and so you could make your adjustments that way if you really had to, which I didn't like doing, but I could do it. But I can't find the eyedropper in the new 2011. I've heard some other people say they just plain got rid of it.
I have not actually looked for it. I've used the Windows version, but I don't know.
Yeah. Okay.
Good luck.
Do you know of any? PowerPoint forum might be best, but I've already looked at some of those.
Right. But I would also take a look just to eliminate one possibility to make sure that you're not running afoul of color management adjustments passively by specifying a color profile or allowing a color profile to be specified by default when you're saving things in Photoshop.
Okay. Well, I'll see what happens.
Okay. Good luck.
Thank you.
And we've got another email message here to take. This says, hello, do I need antivirus software or related software to protect my Mac? I'm a university retiree and used to use a software program, Sophos, something like that, a few years ago, but it went out of existence and I was told I don't need anything. I have a Mac OS X operating software, 10.5.8, that is updated regularly, but not the Leopard version. What software purchases are available to retirees?
Well, the first question is, yes, definitely should have antivirus software on a Macintosh, as well as on Windows machines. One of the primary sources of computer infections, viruses and such, is not just through the operating system, but through files that you may be looking at, QuickTime movies, PDF files, various other kinds of files, and all of the updates in the world to the Mac OS or the Windows operating system, for that matter, won't catch the latest little exploit that may be based on defective or maliciously designed PDF files, QuickTime movies or whatnot. And regularly updated antivirus programs have a much better chance of catching that. So you're probably a little bit less likely to catch have a problem with a virus on a Mac with no antivirus protection, but you are certainly much more likely than those who have antivirus protection.
Yeah.
In terms of retiree, I'm not sure what the policy is of the U of I web store. There are a number of good antivirus products out there, both for Mac and for Windows, and the cost is relatively minimal. It'll be any place, depending on the degree of functionality, between $20 and $50 initially and maybe $40 or $50 per year to keep the subscription renewed, and it's a small price to pay compared to the hassle and difficulty you would have if you do get infected.
Okay. Let's take another call. This is a listener in Urbana on line one. Good morning.
I have a suggestion for the person with the PowerPoint problem.
Yes.
Both the OpenOffice and the Corel products are compatible. And particularly the OpenOffice product, he could get free if his files work properly in that, then the problem is in the new version of PowerPoint.
Yes, that would be an excellent suggestion, and hopefully the listener is hearing this. If indeed one of the other alternatives, OpenOffice or the Corel product, does not have that issue, I would still then think that probably the difficulty is with color profiles and the new version of PowerPoint attempting to make color corrections that it really shouldn't, because most people don't really care about their color matching particular specifications. But yes, that would be an excellent suggestion to try those.
He might even find that he likes those programs better than PowerPoint.
And that's certainly true. Yes. And they're getting better.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
And we've got another email query. I'm looking for a new desktop computer and have checked a few local stores options. It seems like the big stores like Best Buy have the best prices, but smaller computer stores have told me the cheapest big brand computers sometimes skimp on quality and can be costly to fix. I'm looking at computers with an i3 in them, but I don't know who to listen to. Should I go with a big store based simply on price or a smaller local store that claims quality? What's your experience?
Well, there is actually a third option, too, and that is to order directly from the manufacturer via their online web service, such as Hewlett-Packard or Dell or whatever. It is true that a number of the extremely large retailers, the big box stores, in order to keep prices down, have special arrangements. A particular model of computer system from a number of companies can be made with lower cost components, maybe a disk drive or disk controller that's not quite as expensive and maybe therefore not quite as reliable as one that would be more top of the line. It's a problem in almost any area of consumer electronics. Large stores can have custom-made less expensive devices, and those are made, even though the model number may be almost identical, they're not quite the same as, for example, what you might see reviewed in Consumer Reports in terms of even things like televisions and such. So price is certainly a consideration. My own personal preference is, if I'm going with one of the major brands, to see what's available via the website for that particular company. The smaller computer stores are going to give you much better local service, and they've got much better expertise, and so that's a major advantage, and just sort of compare all three.
Okay. And one last call. Line 2 in Urbana will have to be quick, though. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a question about the Finder. I have an iMac, and I noticed that it lists all of my photographs, and I run out of room, and I was wondering if you can delete stuff in the Finder and still keep the images in my program, which is Aperture?
I'm not familiar with Aperture. If Finder is, I would assume, and this is just off the top of my head, if you're seeing them in Finder, that is where the actual file is located. And Aperture and other programs are probably just pointing to them. So if you delete them from Finder, my guess is they are going to be gone.
Oh,
Aperture or other programs may be able to point to little thumbnails, but probably not the full high-quality images that you've got, because those programs aren't going to spend the space generally to store things two or three times.
Okay, because I found an image, a photograph, that I didn't care about, and I deleted it from Finder and went back to Aperture, and there it was.
Well, the question, again, you'd have to check and see how Aperture is storing it. It may be that you are simply seeing a screen-appropriate version of it, and the high resolution, more suitable for printing, may not be stored. We don't really know. The other thing you can do very inexpensively is get an external hard drive that can be hundreds of gigabytes and just move the less used files off onto that. That way, if it turns out that they're not available to you through Aperture or you need more resolution, you can always fetch them back again.
Okay. Well, I can't seem to find anybody who's an expert in Aperture around. So I'm kind of frustrated.
Try web searches, and there should be a forum someplace where you might be able to find an answer.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Good luck.
You're very welcome. And that will do it for the August show about computers, Peter.
It goes quickly.
I know. We'll see you in October.
October, yes.
Okay, so Jim and Debbie will be in next month on September 1st. So that wraps up Focus for this Thursday morning. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our guest has been Peter Kimball of the University of Illinois, our technical director, Jason Croft.